You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
A new Gallup poll released yesterday indicates that more than a third of Americans nationwide believe the mainstream media has been too tough on President Trump.
Which, of course, also indicates that nearly two-thirds of Americans believe the media is either getting it right or needs to go in harder. But how can the press best shore up verifiable reality against President Donald Trump's onslaught? My guests Michael Goldfarb and George Brock will be here to discuss that and the latest from the Trump dimension, including...
Do you feel that my style is wrong or my substance is wrong, trying to fact check the president?
I think it's, and I mean this with truly no disrespect, but I think you can border on being sort of quite a ridiculous figure.
The first signs of a media mutiny against the White House. Could it be that the victims of the Bowling Green massacre did not die in vain? How many more suggestions that the United States is barely any better than Russia will Fox News stand? And what is Donald Trump really afraid of? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, the author and broadcaster, and George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University London. And we will be talking about today's surprise, US President Donald Trump, whose White House has now furnished what they are pleased to describe as evidence of Trump's entrancing assertion that the media had been derelict in reporting Islamist terror attacks. They listed 78 attacks, spelling most of the locations correctly, but including quite a few which weren't really Islamist terror attacks, but which were nonetheless covered, and omitting rather a few more, which were also covered by the media, but whose victims were predominantly Israeli, Arab, African, and or Muslim. George, first of all, the eternal question, or it's becoming the eternal question where Trump is concerned, is his spouting of mad nonsense, which bears no relationship to reality, a deliberate strategy, or does he genuinely not know what he's saying when he's saying it?
I'm beginning to... I started by thinking that he was doing it deliberately. I'm now beginning to wonder, whatever his hard-eyed advisors may think, I'm beginning to wonder whether Trump himself actually can tell the difference between what I would call factual reality and fantasy. He seems to do it so enthusiastically, so fluently, and so naturally, and is so thin-skinned when he gets called out about it, that actually maybe he's just been in a muddle about it all along. I don't think that applies to his advisors, I ought to say, but I think because he is a sui generis, entirely different individual, it's just possible he has a bigger psychological problem than we had realized.
Michael, looking through this absurd document that the White House has produced, and it clearly has just been largely cribbed off Wikipedia by some hapless intern who was yelled at to come up with some supporting evidence for Trump's latest outburst. Is it a reinforcement of the gang who couldn't shoot straight narrative? I mean, it's the fact that they can't spell San Bernardino, they can't spell Denmark, they have several cracks at the word attacker. They get it right about, you know, 50% of the time. And that's not difficult, attacker. That's a...
And don't they have a spell check on the bloody computers in the White House?
San Bernardino, in fairness, that second R is a bit counterintuitive. Denmark's not hard. I mean, how else would you spell Denmark? Well, we know how else you would spell Denmark. D-N-M-A-K-R is how you would otherwise spell it. Attacker's not hard. But is there... We had David Frum, the former George W. Bush speechwriter, on The Daily last week, who described the administration thus far as incompetence tinged with malevolence. Do you think that's about an accurate summary of the balance?
I think that that's probably just about right. And this is how crazy the world is. I never thought I'd wake up one morning and agree with anything that David Frum, who regards as a self-serving jumper from one side of the track to the other, as long as he can keep his snout at power's backside.
We'll tell him you said hi next time he's on.
Please do. He'll think I'm the other Michael Goldfarb who used to work for John McCain's press office and handheld Sarah Palin through the 2008 campaign. There is another Michael Goldfarb who did that, by the way. No, look, there is. I think you've got those are actually the two right adjectives. It's incompetent and it's malevolent, but they pay no price for it. Even though, yes, polls are going down and we're getting down to the core support. We'd be about 38-40%, which is what it was for much of last year. And they don't care. And that's the point, because it doesn't matter. So long as his people, and I was in America just as recently as 10 days ago in rural Virginia, talking to people who I met last year, all in for Trump. They appreciate all the, they even appreciate the, they understand that there may even be malevolence and incompetence. They don't care. He speaks for them. He really does. They don't want to be involved in overseas things. They don't want any foreigners, any more foreigners coming into America. He's personalized it into a Muslim thing, and they'd probably put them at the head of the queue. They don't care. And so long as he's not paying a price with them, then this will carry on. There's no reason for him to change up until the moment there's a genuine rebellion inside his party.
George, further reading of the runes amid this latest fiasco, does it suggest a disconnect between the president and his staff? He quite clearly said during his peculiar oration at CENTCOM that there were terrorist attacks that the media was not reporting. But the spin from the White House is that it's all about under-reporting, which is obviously a nonsensical assertion in itself. But does that distance between the two of them suggests that there are people in the White House who understand that Trump's talking nonsense and they're trying to erect, I guess, a bridge between that and reality?
Well, they're desperately scrambling to do so, but they're going to have a great deal of trouble not least because of the example you've just given. He categorically said that there were terrorist attacks caused by ISIS, which the media were not reporting. He didn't qualify it in any way in that sentence at all. And, you know, naturally people have said, okay, your evidence, please. And they have produced this list you've talked about. It doesn't go anywhere to, and people, of course, have produced example after example after example of online, print, TV, radio, every kind of coverage you can imagine.
It reminds me of one of those, you know, tinfoil hatted cranks you occasionally run across on social media who wants to know why isn't the media covering insert event X, which is relevant to their interests. And however many times you direct them to the coverage of that event, which is probably the reason they know about it in the first place, they will not be talked down. They absolutely insist that, you know, this thing that is being covered is being hushed up due to some ghastly conspiracy.
I mean, there is a kind of potential perverse upside to this. I mean, quite a lot of the American news media is, to a grievous degree, uninterested in the rest of the world outside America. If Donald Trump, using what is usually known as the bully pulpit of the presidency, persuades the American news media to take a bit more of a detailed interest in what's going on in distant continents like Europe, well, you can't say that's necessarily a bad thing. But of course, there's a lot else he's doing and saying that is completely wrong and nonsense.
Well, let's move along slightly, because Trump's accusation that the media has been insufficiently diligent in covering terror attacks occurring in his own head has raised once again a question that recurred throughout his campaign. Was there something, anything so preposterous that he or his proxies could utter that it would prompt news agencies towards mutiny? There are indications that we may have found the answer. Kellyanne Conway, the Trump barker who coined the inadvertently revealing phrase alternative facts, excelled herself with the invention of the Bowling Green Massacre, an atrocity in small town Kentucky, I believe, if I've picked the right state, which never actually occurred. Now, as a consequence, CNN have declined the pleasure of her company on one of their shows. Michael, the phrase CNN used, which was serious questions about her credibility, is an understatement of award-winning proportions. But should all American news outlets now regard all Trump surrogates and indeed Trump himself the same way, with, you know, from the long end of an extremely from the other end of an extremely long barge pole?
Well, they should, and the thing is, you know, Kellyanne Conway is there to go out as a punchbag. I mean, that's what she's there for, and she's very loyal. And every administration has them, right? Or, you know, Democrat or Republican. So fine. But in a lot of ways, she's small potatoes. You know, then you have the Sean Spicer situation. I mean, one of the things that we read in the gossip now that fills Washington is that Kellyanne Conway was angling to replace Sean Spicer, Trump's official press secretary.
What could go wrong?
Well, I mean, it depends on which one of them wants to get a good table at a restaurant sometime in 18 months when Trump has been, you know, turfed out of the White House by the Republicans and Mike Pence is president finally. No, of course, you know, it was about time with her because she was absolutely egregious throughout. I mean, this is the woman who invented, you know, what was it, alternate facts.
Alternative facts.
Alternative facts. Yeah. So you have to say, all right, enough is enough. And she's loyal and Trump rewards loyalty. He'll find another job for her. The main thing is to get the real people with titles. Now, you're not going to get Trump, although Fox News got Trump. We may talk about that later. But the interesting thing was that CBS got Vice President Mike Pence on the same weekend circuit when CNN was declining to, talk about to Kellyanne Conway and made some news out of it because they were talking to someone who actually had some responsibility. So, I mean, I think that one of the problems that has been posed since the origin of 24-hour news is since you can't afford to actually have news reports, it's much cheaper to just interview people. You have too many meaningless interviews that get inflated through conversation within the D.C. media establishment, inside the Beltway establishment, and they actually overshadow news. And people outside the Beltway don't really care. And I think that, you know, it was a smart move for CNN to do it. It's a way of saying, you know, the president has already attacked us in a press conference, you know, viscerally calling us, you know, fake news. Well, you know, we're going to kick back at a lower level person.
George, is it possible that the terrible, shocking, ghastly, non-existent carnage at Bowling Green does prove a turning point?
Yes, I think it is possible. You can never really see the curve until you're a little bit further away from it. I am very struck by how, leave aside the question of guests on rolling news channels, but you know, they talk a lot of nonsense, these people in the administration. But the fact is, the comeback now in the digital age is incredibly quick.
Yes, it is.
You know, it took really a matter of minutes for somebody to say, Bowling Green massacre? Sorry, you know, no one killed. Half an hour later, you had really quite funny visual jokes. You know, a plaque recording the victims of the Bowling Green massacre, blank, and so on.
There were several candlelit vigils, and I believe at least one folk song.
Precisely so, and that didn't take any time at all. So in other words, the comeback is very, very steady. It's very constant. And after all, I mean, there's nothing wrong with TV shows choosing who they have. There are lots of people who are regarded as so cranky, so dishonest, or whatever, who don't get put on TV shows. It just doesn't become a big issue because people aren't expecting to do that with people who represent a presidential administration. But there's nothing wrong with the principle. It's an editorial choice about who you have on your show. There's nothing wrong with it. But, and do I think it's a turning? I really hope it's a turning point. I think it's possible that it is. The only disagreement that I have with all these people who are agonizing about this in the American press is they have a slight tendency to make themselves the story. You know, the media is the story only up to a certain point. And I don't think it helps their case to make themselves the story, certainly not with the part of the electorate that supported Trump.
Although, interestingly, George, I agree with you. I mean, the Washington media has made itself the story, I mean, since I broke into journalism 35 years ago at the Washington Post, and they were making themselves the story then. I found it repulsive. It's one of the reasons I left Washington. But having said
that, the American media is incredibly pleased with itself, even by the standards of media.
I mean, this is one of the reasons I loved when I came here. And the first time I had to do a story for an American outlet, and I had to go to Parliament, I sat in the gallery. And it was, yes, there's a fair amount of ego. Let's be clear that the British parliamentary correspondents are as egotistical as any other parliamentary correspondents.
Of course.
But it comes with a certain amount of you know, self-deprecation and an understanding that they aren't actually making history every day when they report on, you know, the passing fancies of Parliament. But the point that I wanted to make was that Trump himself has put the media on the back foot on this one by making them the story relentlessly.
No, that's quite true.
Whatever the precedents were for criticizing the DC media, now they have been put on the back foot and they have been made into the story. And so it becomes very difficult as you're covering yourself.
But my criticism of them somewhat is that they have fallen into a bit of a trap. I'm not sure that they should be replying so directly. Calling him out when he does something wrong, says something inaccurate, absolutely fine. But if you fall into the trap of becoming an enemy that he can frame, that's probably better for Trump. In some ways, that's better for Trump.
But he's got
to stick to the facts and what is actually happening.
But he came into office, he campaigned with them as the frame. I mean, One of the things that we've learned, you know, there's been one revealing interview with the angel of his worser nature, Steve Bannon, with the New York Times last week. And he said, you are the enemy, you are the opposition. And I don't think that that's a new insight since they took office.
No.
That was something that they understood from the get-go. You make the existing press your enemy, and that's part of the delegitimizing campaign.
But I think you've got to be careful about how you fight it.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Michael Goldfarb and George Brock. Coming up next, what if generations of American paranoia about Russia have been right, but about the wrong party?
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Michael Goldfarb and George Brock. Now, a test for everyone's imaginations. Just picture the reaction among American politics and media if President Barack Obama had mildly opined that the United States was other than innocent, pure and noble, and further implied a moral equivalence with the Russia of Vladimir Putin, lest we forget a former spook whose day job for years was literally waging covert war upon America. President Donald Trump did precisely this in his pre-Super Bowl interview with Fox News' Paramount bloviator Bill O'Reilly and remains gainfully employed as we go to air.
I do respect him.
Do you? But why?
Well, I respect a lot of people, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get along with them.
Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We've got a lot of killers. Well, you think our country's so innocent? You think our country's so innocent?
I don't know of any government leaders that are killers in America.
Well, take a look at what we've done, too. We've made a lot of mistakes. I've been against the war in Iraq from the beginning.
Yeah, mistakes are different then.
A lot of mistakes, okay, but a lot of people were killed.
Michael, do we draw any encouragement from the fact that even Bill O'Reilly blanched at this?
This is one of those moments when radio is actually inadequate. You actually have to see the visuals and, you know, the backstory on who Bill O'Reilly is, what Fox News is, and who Donald Trump is. This is, again, two nations. So on the Trump side, they look at that and they will say, this is our man. He speaks what's on his mind. There's no filtering going on. This is what he says. And yes, we do. They will take moral equivalence and say, you know, I mean, if I had phrased the question instead of O'Reilly, I would have said Vladimir Putin has journalists are murdered under Vladimir Putin.
Regularly.
So why is that, and been specific about what he meant by killer. And then what would Trump have said? And it's created trouble. This one actually has created trouble, possibly even more than Bowling Green Massacre out of the mouth of Kellyanne Conway. Because Mike Pence, in that interview I was talking about earlier, was asked directly about it. And he tried to evade and avoid what his boss had said. Four times the CBS interviewer asked him before he could finally be forced to say, yes, America is better than Russia. And as someone who was born in the 1950s and knows all about the Cold War and knows people who were blacklisted for their closeness to the Soviet Union, to see the Republican Party actually apologizing for a Russian dictator is, to me, makes me think that, Andrew, you may not be real. And in fact, this whole thing may be some incredible acid hallucination.
Andrew, you were asking about turning points. I mean, it matters a lot for the immediate future what Trump's relations to the Republican Party are, and making it a moral equivalence between America and Russia, really, never mind the Bowling Green Massacre, never, you know, making that moral equivalence, I think, is very unpopular with the Republicans. I think Michael agrees. And we may see that. I mean, if he goes on doing that, if he's really determined to keep that strange equivalence up, and he separates himself from the Republicans, then his position in the end is weaker. He doesn't. It's complex, and I'm sure Michael will have something to say about this. But I mean, he's not dependent on the Republican Party. But on the other hand, if they're actively hostile to him, then he's in some much greater difficulty than he is at the moment.
Looking beyond the Republican Party, though, is it possible, and if we recall that this interview was recorded for and broadcast by Fox News, Michael, is it possible to imagine that, well, it wouldn't be the first time that Rupert Murdoch has turned his guns around, or as they used to call it on Fleet Street, enacted the reverse ferret?
It's possible. I mean, this is where the difficulties of journalism in this era go, because, I mean, how many people actually know what Rupert Murdoch really thinks, and how many people actually have context that can make a reasonable judgment about what Trump is thinking? I don't even know that Trump knows what he's thinking from one moment to the next. Interesting point, though, Andrew, because this morning, in an unrelated thing, his wife, Melania Trump, was going to sue the Daily Mail for libel, and then she's dropped the charge. And the charge sheet appeared in the New York Post, which is also, it's very embarrassing both to Melania and by inference to Donald Trump, this attempt to blag money out of the Daily Mail. I don't object to that, but I mean, what, you know, came in the New York Post. So is Rupert Murdoch turning his fire on Donald Trump? It's possible. It could be the reverse ferret, as you say, but it was extraordinary, although you have to know a lot about American media inside baseball to understand just how extraordinary that interview was.
What do you think, George? Again, it's difficult to know what Rupert Murdoch is going to perceive as in his interest. But if, say, Fox News did become, let's say, more ambivalent in its coverage of Trump, would that make a difference?
Yes, I suppose it would make some difference in the American electorate, although we just have to remember that, you know, Trump is, as far as that 40% that Michael was talking about, you know, is a Teflon-covered politician right now. So I don't think you would get any immediate or dramatic change. But to some extent, he was made by Rolling News, he was made by Fox News and Facebook and a whole series of other things. I don't think he would be undone by Fox News. But I think you'd have to see, you know, if they were really going to be systematically hostile to him rather than just opportunistically, as they might have been at the moment. Yeah, could be.
And we give Rupert Murdoch a lot of credit, but we really need to give Vladimir Putin a lot more credit, because Trump can't square the circle between wanting to start a war with Iran and the fact that Russia and Iran are very close. They're working together in Syria, and there is a benefit to Russia in the nuclear agreement with Iran. And I'm not sure Trump has figured out that he's actually got to put these two in, separate these two, and I don't think he can. Putin is the real player, as always.
Well, finally tonight, in our all Trump special, Richard Nixon, who's starting to seem pretty reasonable by comparison, had been president for 4 years before it became known that he maintained an actual list of his enemies. It's not known whether Trump bothers to write his down. It does seem safe to assume that this would take him a while, but it is clear that he does see the world as very much divided between those for him and those against. The big question of what is he afraid? George, are we divining any consistent theme in who he lashes out against? Or against whom he lashes out?
Well, I mean, it would take me hours, Andrew, to list all of that in full. But let me just pick one example. He is very, very easily riled by judges. He's not alone in that. But what is the? There are two medium-term threats to Trump. One is the Republican Party really thinking we have to do something about this. This has gone beyond a joke. The other, obviously, is a court, perhaps even the Supreme Court, just striking down some large plank, or indeed several planks, of what he's trying to do.
Because the courts, of course, are the only arm of government he does not presently control.
Indeed, and he is doing his best to intimidate them. Well, I must say, criticizing a judge who was appointed by George W. Bush, the man who struck down the immigration and visa ban, new rules, is an odd way of doing it, but it illustrates, I think, that Trump is just, it's his personal interest. He sees it entirely in kind of individual, in individual terms. Whether that's going to be a long-term theme, I don't know.
What do you think, Michael? When he goes after the courts, or indeed anybody else who drifts across his sights, is it an attempt to assert dominance, or is it an expression of fear? I do realise that with your chronic bullies, the two are very often combined.
I think that that's probably the case. I mean, I think there's a pathology at work in him, and I think he is a bully, and there's a pathology, and he may not be able to write at all, but he certainly has a memory, and he would remember everyone who ever crossed him. And because in his business life he was constantly involved in lawsuits,
true,
so he has to, you know which judges, you know, cut him a break and which judges didn't. I think that, you know, we'll see that today the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals in San Francisco, is hearing his appeal of this judge in Washington State's ruling against the immigration ban. And we'll see what happens. And he will probably lose there. And he will immediately appeal to the Supreme Court, which only has 8 justices. And we'll see what happens there. And, you know, Richard Nixon pushed and pushed. And in the end, the Republicans were, as the Republicans in Congress joined with the Democrats in 1973 asserted that there is a third branch of government and it is independent of the executive. My guess is that these Republicans are very cynical and they need 6 to 9 months to get their extraordinarily right-wing agenda pushed through Congress. And once they've done that, they will turn on Trump. And Mike Pence is one of them. And they would happily impeach him and install Mike Pence as president midway through his term. I mean, that's my prediction for today, and I was wrong last year. So listen to me now. You
know? I was wrong about everything in 2016. I've given up predicting.
I too, was wrong about everything in 2016. But one of the things that people did take refuge in 2016, and probably just a final thought for tonight, George, and I confess to having been somewhat lulled by this myself, was the idea that Trump's bluster and belligerence throughout the campaign was just showbiz. That was him doing what he had to do to get elected, and that once he was in office, he would calm down and probably govern as a fairly straightforward, somewhat tedious, middle-of-the-road Republican. Do we have to, at this point, nearly three weeks in, abandon the idea that he's going to grow into the office?
I did think he would calm down a bit. I did think he would mature a bit, but I did never think he was a Republican. He's not a tribal party politician in the slightest. It comes all out of his instincts.
And Michael, very final thought, do we have to give up on that hope?
I never had that hope. I saw that the match between his supporters and him, he is who he is, and we'll have to live with it for as long as he's there.
Well, on that happy thought, that brings us to the end of today's episode of Midori House. Michael Goldfarb and George Brock, thanks for joining us. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Furse. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next. At 1900, it's Monocle's dedicated design show, Section D, and there's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.